Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, and welcome to The Art of Film Funding. I'm your co-host, Claire Papin, along with Carol Dean, author of the best-selling book, The Art of Film Funding. Carol is also the founder and president of From the Heart Productions and the host of this show.
4 years, Steve Kaplan has been one of the industry's most respected and sought-after experts on comedy. His first book, The Hidden Tools of Comedy, is a bestseller in its field, released in audio. And his second book is The Comic Hero's Journey, Serious Story Structure for Fabulously Funny Films. Steve has taught workshops at companies such as DreamWorks, Disney Animation, NBC's Writers on the Verge, and others. He conducts private coaching and one-on-one consultations, and has taught his comedy intensive workshops around the world, from Los Angeles to Mumbai to New York, from Australia to Rio. He also offers classes online via Zoom. You can find out all about it at KaplanComedy.com. And Carol, Steve has the same publisher as you do, Michael Wiese Publications, right?
Absolutely. Steve Kaplan is published by the top film publisher, and we thank you for joining us, Steve.
Totally my pleasure.
Good. Well, we want to learn about comedy, and we want to hear about your book, The Hidden Tools of Comedy, The Serious Business of Being Funny. Great title. So let's start with how you got started in the film industry.
Well, I originally got started in the film industry by not being in the film industry. I started out as a theater director. A couple of actors, friends of mine, wanted to start a theater in New York, and they asked me to join in, and I pitched them a theater that was completely devoted to comedy, which was, at that time in New York, not very usual. And so we started it. We called it the Manhattan Punchline, and it wasn't a stand-up club. It was a theater completely devoted to comedy, and we did Shakespeare. We did original plays. We produced stand-up nights. We produced, we had an improv group. One of the main people in the improv group was Michael Patrick King, who later went on to do Sex and the City and Two Broke Girls. And so I did that for about a dozen years, about 13 years. And it was a not-for-profit theater. I didn't realize I was taking it all too seriously because it was definitely not-for-profit. And when we closed, I thought, what can I do with all this information that I have about comedy? And so I went to Los Angeles. I got a gig at HBO, doing some developmental work for them. And along the way, somebody said to me, you know, you can do for comedy what Robert McKee does for story. And I said, really? And he said, yeah, so let's try it out. So I did a small workshop in Los Angeles. And very shortly, I started doing workshops, as you said in the intro, in New York, in London, in Tel Aviv. And because I was doing that and I was working with writers, I started doing work for producers and writers both in the United States and in Australia and around the world. So that's how I kind of got started in the film industry, by focusing on one thing that was important to me, and that's what comedy is, how it works, why it works, what's happening when it doesn't work, and what can you do to fix it.
And what can you do to fix it, right. Okay, well, let's start with what you think comedy is. How can you describe comedy for us?
Well, a lot of people think comedy is simply, you know, what you're laughing at. If it's funny, if you're laughing at it, that's comedy. But if you really think about that, I have a little niece, and if I when she was very little, if I shook my keys at her, she would laugh at that. So to her, that was funny. But you wouldn't take a set of keys and shake them to an agent at CAA and say, would you sign me? Maybe I can develop this into a feature. So comedy is not just about laughter, although, that's an important part. Comedy is the art of telling the truth. And specifically, it's the art of telling the truth about human beings. And comedy's about somebody who is an ordinary or less than ordinary person struggling against insurmountable odds without many of the required skills and tools with which to win, yet never giving up hope. That's a paradigm that not only describes most performance comedy I can think of, it also describes the human condition, because we're all struggling against insurmountable odds without all the skills and tools with which to win. For instance, we're not immortal, we're not omnipotent, we're not omniscient, and yet we still wake up the next day, every day, trying our best to make it through another day and to even make the day that we're in a little bit better. So the paradigm of the human condition is also the paradigm that describes performance comedy. I think Jerry Lewis once said, it's about a man in trouble. Buster Keaton said, you get a man up a tree, you throw rocks at him, you get the man down from the tree. It's all about somebody very much like us struggling against something that's outside of their control, and not giving up. So you take these elements and what you can do is you can draw from this paradigm, this what we call the comedy equation, and you can draw usable, practical tools. And that's what my first book is about, the hidden tools of comedy. Everybody knows about, the rules of three, and there's been tons of books written on comedy structures, and Steve Allen wrote a book, and Gene Perrett, who used to write for Bob Hope, wrote a book, and there are all these little tricks and tools in terms of writing comedy. But the book that I wrote was about the hidden tools, the things that people aren't being taught in colleges or universities, and that if you dig deep into how comedy is working and what's happening, these are useful practical tools in terms of creating comedy.
Right, practical tools, and yes, that's exactly right. Well, let's talk about Groundhog Day, because you're really good at taking films and analyzing them, and so what was going on in that film? Can you give us some guidance?
Well, in my second book, the Comic Hero's Journey, we take the idea of some of these hidden tools, some of these techniques and practices, and then we apply it to story structure. And what we do is we take a look at how is a comic film developed, and what's the journey of a comic film, the protagonist in a comic film. Everybody knows the hero's journey. My friend Chris Vogler wrote The Writer's Journey, which plays off of Joseph Campbell's work on The Hero of a Thousand Faces. And everybody knows the hero's journey. If you've seen Star Wars, you've seen the hero's journey with the ordinary world and the call of meeting the mentor and refusing the call. And if you've seen Star Wars, you know that Luke eventually finds the greatness within and then goes off and works for the rebellion and kills the Death Star. In a comic story, we start with a lie, what we call a comic premise, the lie that tells the truth, something that could never happen or probably could never happen. But since it does happen, it asks the question, well, what would happen next? And Groundhog Day has a great comic premise. A guy wakes up every day, and it's the same day. It's Groundhog Day. And that's a lie. That could never happen, right? But if it does happen, what can happen next? And what's great about Groundhog Day is that it does a couple of things. For one, it's never dishonest. In other words, it doesn't add to that lie. It doesn't tell another lie. There are no other lies in Groundhog Day. He wakes up the same day and he has to deal with it. So in a great comic premise, you are focused then on character, because character is everything in comedy. It's all about character. And if you look at the first draft of Groundhog Day, it starts in the during the middle of the third day. And if those of you out in the audience have not watched Groundhog Day, it's basically this guy, Phil Connors, who's a cynical kind of a jerk. And he doesn't even want to go to this Groundhog Day festival. And he goes there and he's nasty and he's selfish. And he, for some reason, he just wakes up the same day every day, and he can't get out of that. And what happens is that as he's going through this experience where he can't wake up tomorrow, and he tries to kill himself and he can't even kill himself. He just keeps on waking up on Groundhog Day. He starts to realize that the way he's been living his life, which has been selfishly and taking advantage of other people, becomes meaningless. It becomes very shallow. And he finally realizes that if I'm going to be stuck here for the rest of eternity, what am I going to do with it? And he thinks to himself, well, I might as well be of service to others. I might as well be a good person. And that's what's brilliant about Groundhog Day. It's funny. I mean, it's got Bill Murray's greatest performance. But it also has heart, because it's not just about gags. It's about a guy who's growing as a human being and who's growing to appreciate other people. Because he's stuck in this town, he knows everything about those people. Whereas before in his life, he wouldn't care about anybody else who he comes into contact with. Who cares? But because he's stuck there, he learns the personal stories of everybody in that town. And it also is philosophical, because one of the things about a comic premise is that it's developed by characters, and characters are brought on into a story by need and theme. You have a scene with a boy and a girl at a cafe. Who do you need? You need a waiter or a waitress. But characters are also brought on through theme. In Groundhog Day, the theme is, how can you be a good person in the world? And so look who's not in Groundhog Day. His mother's not in Groundhog Day, because it has nothing to do with family. The president of the United States is not in Groundhog Day, or a senator, or a congressman, because it has nothing to do with politics. There's a character in the second draft of Groundhog Day that isn't in the movie. It's the character of Stephanie. And Stephanie, in the second draft, was put there because the producers, the studio executives said, nobody's going to understand how this happens. This is crazy. Somebody living the same day over and over again. Audiences will be confused. You got to put something in the script that explains it. So, because the golden rule is those who have the gold make the rules. You go and you put that into the script. So they created this character of Stephanie. And in the second draft, which if you Google Groundhog Day, the second draft will come up, written by Harold Ramis and Danny Rubin. And Stephanie is this girl who Phil Connors has dated and then dumped, and she's still kind of feels bad about that. And she's also into Ouija boards and crystals, and she puts a curse on him. Okay, we've seen plenty of movies like that. But here's the problem. The problem is that if there's a character of Stephanie in there, the theme is no longer how can you be a good person in the world. It's how can you be a better boyfriend, because don't you have to bring Stephanie back at the end to take the curse off of him? So when you're developing a comic premise, a comic story like Groundhog Day, and you develop it from this lie that tells the truth, this impossible or improbable occurrence, and then you develop it organically and honestly through character and theme, theme tells you what you need to do. Theme tells you, if this is asking the question, how can you be a good person? Well, maybe we don't need to do some stupid gags that don't get there, and that's just what we would consider to be, wouldn't it be, in quotes, quote, wouldn't it be funny if, unquote. There's an example of this. Stephen Tobolowsky, who plays the obnoxious insurance salesman, tells the story that in the when they were making Groundhog Day in the original shooting script, there's this scene in which Bill Murray, Phil Connors, has already lived through this day twice, and he's trying to figure out what's going on, what's really happening. So there's this scene in which he shaves his head into a mohawk. He destroys the room in the bed and breakfast. He throws paint all over the place. He completely destroys it, and they shot it at great expense. And then when they looked at the dailies, Harold Ramis and Bill Murray kind of looked at each other and says, why would he do that? And they realized, oh, he's only doing that because somebody thought it would be funny. But what would the character really do? What would the character really do? And so at great expense, they reshot the scene. And in the reshot scene, all Phil Connors does is he breaks a pencil. And he puts a part of the pencil on the floor and the other part on the night table. And he wakes up the next morning with, you know, the song of the Sonny and Cher song playing. And the pencil is whole on the night table. Because, and as Stephen Tobolowsky explains it, from that moment on, everything in the film became, what would Phil do? What would they do, as opposed to what would be funny if they did? And so one of the things about Groundhog Day and about great comedies is that it not only appeals to your sense of humor, it makes you laugh, it makes you care, but it also makes you think. And that's why Groundhog Day has been adopted by every major religion. People have written Danny Rubin and said, this is the greatest Buddhist movie ever made. This is the greatest Jewish movie ever made. This is the greatest Catholic movie ever made, because it says something universal and eternal that touches us, as opposed to just, wouldn't it be funny, somebody slips on a banana peel, pie in your face. So a great comedy is not only has a great premise, a great setup, it has great characters, and it has great meaning. It has a theme. And, you know, some people think of theme as like a message, like Romeo and Juliet, love conquers all. But if you really think about it, those kids were dead at the end of Romeo and Juliet, right? So maybe love didn't conquer all. Because what Shakespeare really is doing is he's asking the question, what's the nature of love? And so every character in Romeo and Juliet is some aspect of that. The love of Romeo for Juliet, the love of Romeo for Rosalind, the woman who Romeo loves at the beginning of the play, who dumps him, and that's why he's all emo and upset, and his best friends, Benvolio and Mercutio, take him to the party where he meets Juliet. The possessive, evil, malicious love of Cousin Tybalt for Juliet. Every character in Romeo and Juliet is some aspect that answers the question, what's the nature of love? So when you're writing a comedy, rather than just thinking about the jokes, because funny is subjective. If you're chasing funny, you're by definition excluding some portion of the audience, because, you know, some people think this is funny, some people don't think this is funny. But comedy is the thing that tells the truth, and specifically it tells the truth about people. And that's why the best comedies aren't afraid to not stop being funny at a certain point when things look lost, when all hope is lost. Because if you go back to the comic equation, ordinary people struggling against insurmountable odds without many of the required skills and tools, without giving up hope, well, if your characters give up hope, that makes it a dramatic moment, which if you think about every good comedy.
Okay, we seem to have lost Steve.
All right. Well, let's just give it a moment. I'm sure he will call back in. And I don't know if you can hear us, Steve, but if you can, we cannot hear you at the moment. So do call back in. And in the meantime,
so
I have to. Yes, please.
Interesting,
go ahead.
Claire, is that the film created such, it allowed him to do things like he stole money from the armed guard, you know, which is impossible to do. No one robs the armed guards, but he did. He did everything that he could do and got away with it. It wasn't any fun. So he eventually became a really nice person. At the end of the film, you love him. The person he's become, because he knows everybody in town, knows their weaknesses, knows how to support them and help them. And then he gets married and says, let's live here forever because it is such a great town. And I think that's really what sold me on the film. By the end of the film, I realized the changes the guy had made in his life. And we got to enjoy the comedy all along the way. I had to go back and see it again, and it changed for me. From the first time I saw it, I don't think I got the full impact of the film. But then Roger Ebert tells us that the films don't change, we change, Claire.
Yes.
And we are different. So it was 20 years ago when I saw it. So I really enjoyed it much better. And after reading Steve's book, The Tools of Comedy, I had an idea of what was going on and what to look for.
Yeah.
I'm back.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
I just talked so long that I don't know where you lost me.
Well, you were talking about comedy and how important it is to stay within the character, do things the character would do. And I think the key point for all of us, not everybody caught the fact that he broke the pencil in half and it was whole the next day, told him and all of the audience he can get away with anything, which he then went forward doing. He robbed the armored truck, et cetera, right?
Right. And some people don't realize is that the movie of Groundhog Day is following the same steps of grief as Elizabeth Kubler-Ross wrote out, that when he's living and when he wakes up the same day, it's denial, then anger, then negotiation. That's where he's starting to rob the armored truck, and he's seducing all the girls in town. And then there's depression. That's the sequence in which he's killing himself over and over and over again, and then acceptance. And so Groundhog Day has a really unique structure, and And within that structure, I'm not sure whether I was cut off while I was talking about it, is that it has a great theme. And the theme is how can you be a good person in the world?
And that comes across in the very end. And I hated to see that film end. Because by now I've really had invested time in the character. I knew everybody in town just like he did. So that becomes a yearly thing. That's a fun thing for any holiday, family.
Right. Yeah, it's one of the great comedies. But there's a lot of great comedies. People sometimes ask, "What's your favorite comedy?" And that's like, you know, asking a parent, "Well, who's your favorite kid?" Unless the parent's a really creepy person and says, "Well, Joe's my favorite kid, but Tommy I hate." I love Groundhog Day. I love Dr. Strangelove. I mean, they're all great films.
Oh, Dr. Strangelove, to me, was one of the best comedies. And I have to see that every 3 or 4 years. It's just hysterical. It's a great way to relax and get rid of tension because
the end of the world.
Yes, it's still happening, all of that. You can't fight in here. This is the war room, you know.
This is the war room. Strangelove, Dr. Strangelove is one of the most successful satires. Satire is really hard to do because satire is the comedy of ideas, and you can communicate an idea without necessarily having great characters attached to it. And what really makes Dr. Strangelove stand apart, in addition to the fact that Peter Sellers plays all those roles, is the fact that those characters are so human. For me, the funniest thing is when the president, also played by Peter Sellers, is calling the Russian premier, and it sounds like every conversation, you know, that my uncle and aunts would have. You know, so Dmitry, you know, I'm happy to talk to you, and it's just so human and so true. One of the rules of thumb in comedy is take what's ordinary and make it mythic, take what's mythic and make it ordinary. And that's what they do in the war room. They're taking the mythic scene of the president of the United States and the premier of Russia talking about, you know, life and death and nuclear war. And they're just making it very ordinary. The way people talk on the phone and sometimes get misunderstood and say no, you're not asking. Oh no, I would be happy to talk to you again, Dmitry. That's always my favorite stuff.
Yes. No, he was very humble. It showed us that what he had to go through, how he had to be very flexible and try to support. And the guy's furious. Anyway, yes, I love that. But Peter Sellers, I read that the director just let Sellers go and do anything he wanted. You let him improvise. And that's how he got such outrageous work from Peter in those scenes.
Yeah, he was an extremely talented person, very tortured, full of tortured self-doubt, but there are some films that have really captured his genius. This is one of them. I kind of like the Pink Panther. But what I really like is the fact that he could go from the satire, the broad character sketches in Dr. Strangelove, to being there, which is another satire of the confluence between politics and entertainment, and in which he plays this very simple gardener that everybody just assumes is something more than what they are. And I think that's still very relevant today. And it just showed what a genius actor he was, because he totally inhabited those roles. In Dr. Strangelove, he was actually supposed to play a fourth role. He was supposed to play the pilot of the plane, and he was supposed to be the one to ride the bomb down. But when he was working on it, he said, "I can't do it because I can't master the Texas accent." So that's why they hired Slim Pickens to be the captain.
Pickens was perfect.
He's so talented, but yet he's also racked by doubt, and he just didn't think that he would be able to pull off a Texas accent, which I don't know. I think he could have.
Well, it was a memorable film. All of his work is, and Groundhog Day, too. But it's wonderful. Thank you so much for explaining all of this. And you do mention Charlie Chaplin a lot in your books. And there's got to be something wonderful, because it's 100 years ago he made these films, and we're still watching them today. So what did he do that was so great that we still admire and love him?
I would say again that he just exhibited his humanity throughout the films. He's certainly not the richest. He's not the brightest. But he keeps trying his best to help the blind girl, or to figure out how to, you know, serve these. When he's playing the waiter, he's trying to serve all these plates while everybody's dancing, and it's impossible. Or he tries to earn some money in a boxing match. One of the funniest scenes is during the boxing match, and you can see that he's not athletic and he's kind of scared about being hit, but he gets up and the bell rings and he immediately stands behind the referee. And as the referee's moving, he keeps behind the referee. He's standing behind the referee. And the minute the referee kind of looks one way, he punches the opponent. Then he gets behind the referee again. And it's brilliant comedy, because it both says, I'm scared. I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm not an idiot. I'm smart enough to at least stand behind somebody who's bigger than me. So that's a brilliant sequence. And at the end of the sequence, he gets knocked out, because again, what would really happen if Charlie Chaplin was in a boxing match? One of the reasons that we love Chaplin is the same reason that we love Pixar, is that it's Pixar movie. The trope is that comedy doesn't travel. You can't laugh at a movie or a television show made in France or Germany or Finland, because, you know, what would we know about that, and vice versa? What would they care about American comedy? And yet the truth is that everybody in the world loves Friends. They know Friends. They've watched every episode. Everybody in the world loves Pixar. Now, Pixar movies are dubbed into the local language, but it's still the same movie, and still with the same characters and the same story. So what we love about Charlie Chaplin is that it's universal, his universal humanity, and that humanity, without the restriction of language, is available to everybody, because everybody shares the same things that great comedians do. It's tough to get by. They don't have all the skills when they try to get by. They have to deal with challenges. And what makes Chaplin funny is that he never gives up. He keeps getting knocked down, but he keeps getting back up. And there are a lot of us who have a hard time getting back up. And comedians give us the hope and the strength that maybe we can do that too.
Exactly. Well, I wanted to ask you about the second book, The Hidden Tools of Comedy, and tell us how you decided to write that.
Well, you know, earlier before we went on the air, you asked me how long it took me to write the book. And because I've been teaching comedy, working in comedy for a long, long, long time. And I said, well, it took me 25 years to write the book, but the first 22 years were my struggle with it wasn't good enough. I wasn't smart enough. Everybody knows this or nobody would care about it. When I started the comedy theater, Manhattan Punchline, I thought I knew everything there was to know about comedy in the arrogance of youth. And then as I was working on it for a little while, I thought to myself, okay, I don't know everything that's funny, but I know what's not, you know, I know what's not funny, gosh darn it. And then shortly after that, I thought to myself, I don't know how this stuff works. Why is something funny on a Thursday no longer funny on a Sunday? Because I was doing performances, live performances, and a Thursday audience would laugh uproariously, and then they would do the same stuff, I thought the same stuff, on Sunday, and it was crickets. And so I started to really explore and investigate why is this stuff working? What is it? How does it work? Why does it work? And when it's not working, okay, what can you do to fix it? And out of that, I started doing experiments. I was teaching an improv class at the time, and I started devising experimental games and exercises and techniques in order to try to figure this stuff out. And out of that came this 40-week masterclass in comedy that I was teaching at my theater in New York. And when I moved to Los Angeles, we took those 40 weeks and we kind of, you know, given the attention span of people in Los Angeles, we kind of squoze it into a week. And so I started, as I said, I started teaching these workshops, these weekend workshops for writers. And I would teach them. And at some point, somebody said, you should put this stuff into a book. And I tried to put it into a book. But like I said, I would write two sentences and I would then tear it up because, oh, this is stupid. Or I would write two sentences and then tear it up because, oh, everybody knows this. Or I would write two sentences and then tear it up.
Well, it looks like the line may have dropped again.
Okay.
So I'm going to send him a text and let him know that his line dropped because he may be still sharing the story. But in the meantime,
yes.
Carol, while I'm doing that, I would love for you to reflect on the whole process of what he goes through that you did read from the book that stands out for you.
Well, I will. What I'll do is I'll just share some of the outlines here in the table of contents. He starts with the myth of comedy. That's really important to understand what's the real truth and make sure you get rid of the myths. And then it goes into comedy perception test. And that's shocking to realize that what's funny to millions of people may not be funny to you. And then you get into the, oh my gosh, how do you work with an audience when you're not sure who's going to laugh at what? And then the comic equation. And then he starts to introduce tools and gets into the winning tools, tells you about the non-heroes and the metaphorical relationships, positive action an active emotion. That's really important because emotion is so important in comedy. And then you go into the straight and the wavy line and archetypes, and then the comic premise. And that's all
right.
In part two and one. Hi.
Right. So the tools are kind of drawn from the comic equation, the idea of winning. Comedy gives your characters the permission to win. So when your characters are doing something weird and odd, as opposed to them doing it because, quote unquote, wouldn't it be funny if they did that? They're doing it because they have to do that in order to get what they want. So there's a scene in Annie Hall in which the Alvy Singer, the character Alvy Singer, is having an argument standing on a movie line with some professor from Columbia University. And the professor says something about, well, Marshall McLuhan used to say this. And Woody Allen says, well, I happen to have Marshall McLuhan right here. And he pulls Marshall McLuhan out from behind a poster. And Marshall McLuhan tells him he's an idiot. And Woody Allen turns to the camera and says, if only life were like this. So comedy gives your character the permission to win. But it also gives your characters the permission to do what they need to do in order to win. There's an I Love Lucy episode in which Lucy and Ethel are trying to prove to the boys that they can go out into the workplace and earn a living. This is the 50s in which women weren't supposed to do that. And so they get a job at a candy factory, and they're supposed to wrap these candies as they're going by on the conveyor belt. And at first it's fine. And then the conveyor belt speeds up. And they are getting behind and they can't. And the woman, you know, the supervisor comes in and says, let's see how they're doing. And so they take all the candies that they haven't been able to wrap, and they put them in their brassieres, and they put them in their hat, and they put stuff in their mouth. And you're laughing. But if you look at it, they're not trying to do it in a funny way. They're just trying to do it.
To survive. They want to survive.
Right. The task of doing something that it's impossible to do and trying to do it without giving up creates comedy. I used to do an exercise in which I asked somebody, somebody says, I'm not funny at all. I have no sense of humor. So I would say, great, come up here. So I would stand them at the front of the workshop and I would hand them a book. Hold this. Then I hand them another book. Hold that. Then I'd hand them a hat. Hold that. Then I hand them a chair. Hold that. Then I'm hand them another chair. Hold that. And as long as they didn't say, this is stupid, I give up, the audience would start to crack up because it's impossible. But if you're trying to do something that you have no skills or not enough skills to do and you don't give up, you're going to create comedy because you're trying to accomplish something. And so the second tool is non-hero. A non-hero is not the greatest idiot. It's simply somebody who lacks some, if not all, the essential skills and tools to win. And one of the things we say is the most important rule is to don't know. Because I'm working with writers, when you're writing, you're so smart, you've got all this information in your head, and you kind of want to give it to all your characters, but your characters don't know. And that doesn't mean that you're writing your characters to make them stupid. It's just that they don't know. One of the things that I do in a workshop is I'll pick somebody out and I'll say, did you hear that a door flew off of a Boeing airplane and fell to the ground? And they say, yeah. I said, so for all we know, there's an airplane flying right above us, right? And the door's fallen off, and it's falling right towards us. I mean, for all we know, right? And so for all we know, this door is heading right for you. It's going to crush you. And you know, the guy kind of says, whoa, whoa. So I say, so what do you hope it doesn't happen? And the guy would say, yeah, sure, I hope it doesn't happen. What's your guess? You guess it's going to happen? And they'll invariably say, I guess it won't happen. And then I'll ask, are you 100% sure it's not going to happen? And if they're honest, they have to say, well, I can't be 100% sure. And then I make the point that we live our lives every 5 seconds in hopes and guesses. We hope something big doesn't fall on us. We guess it won't, but we're not sure. The only people who are sure are people in soap operas or action films. You know, Daniel Craig gets into a room with 12 guys with guns, and he kind of knows what he's going to do. He scopes it out. He's got all the skills. But you put Kristen Wiig in a room with 12 guys with guns, and, you know, comedy is going to occur because she doesn't have the skills, but she's going to try to figure it out even though she doesn't have the skills. So there's non-hero. And the idea of straight line, wavy line is the idea that John Cleese once said when they started Monty Python, they thought that comedy was watching somebody do something silly. They later came to realize that comedy is watching somebody watch somebody do something silly. So straight line, wavy line is the idea that rather than thinking that your characters have to be witty and making jokes all the time, a lot of times, not all the time, but a lot of times what's happening is some character is creating a problem or is blind to a problem, and another character is struggling with the problem but doesn't quite know how to fix it because they're a non-hero. So the idea of straight line, wavy line is that the character in focus, the character who's struggling, is the character who's most like us, just a normal person. And the other character could be crazy or nutty or stupid. So if you think about Seinfeld, in which Kramer runs in the room. Kramer runs and does something stupid. And what does Jerry do? Jerry just kind of looks at Kramer. He doesn't necessarily say something funny. One of the things that Seinfeld did so well is that they destroyed the setup punch structure of sitcoms. And if you think of Friends, I mean, if Joey says something stupid, there's always somebody there to give him a look like, what did you just say? Without necessarily saying something clever as well. So this idea of straight line, wavy line is that no matter what craziness is happening in the scene, there's got to be a human being in the equation. There's got to be a human being there. It's what we say that you can't have Mork without Mindy. You can't have craziness without some measure of humanity, some human being dealing with the problem and not quite knowing what to do.
Wow, that's beautiful. That's well said. Thank you so much. Well, tell us about your workshops and where do we go to find more information on that?
Well, I used to come to a city very close to you, something happened in 2020. And I can't remember what. What was that thing that happened in 2020? It was something about a ball with lots of spikes in it. It's hard to remember. But anyway, when the pandemic happened, I sat for about 6 months going, okay, I am supposed to be in New York. I have to cancel that. I'm supposed to be in London. I have to cancel that. So there was just a lot of canceling. And then people started to ask me because we're stuck, can you come on Zoom and can you give us a lecture? Can you come on Zoom and talk about comedy for 2 hours? And so I started to do that, and I started to realize, oh, I can do 90% of what my live workshops used to be like, but on Zoom. And so in October of 2020, I offered the Comedy Intensive online for the first time, and it kind of was wildly successful. So now I teach online. You can go to kaplancomedy.com. I'm teaching the hidden tools online, and I'm also teaching a course in the comic hero's journey, what we call write your comedy screenplay, and I'm soon to add to that write your comedy pilot. But thankfully, live workshops have started up again. So last November, I taught a week at the University of Rhode Island. This coming December, I'm going to be teaching at the University of Milan, and I'm probably going to be also teaching a workshop in London. And the London workshop isn't set, but if you go and join our mailing list at KaplanComedy.com, you'll find out all about it.
Okay, KaplanComedy.com.
Right, KaplanComedy, comedy.com, and join our mailing list, and I will send you the occasional, somewhat monthly newsletter, and then I'll kind of besiege you with notices about what we're doing.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. We really appreciate this information. It is it's so simple when you talk about it, but it's something that has taken years to come to these decisions and to really get clear on what works. And that's where you were one of the times talking about what works on a Sunday or on a Thursday night doesn't do a thing on a Sunday night because the audience
right.
has changed, right?
No, it's not. But actually what we found out that it wasn't the audience. It was the actors were unconsciously doing something to undercut their comic performance. And what they were doing is they were taking what the characters were doing and making them a little bit more logical and a little bit more appropriate, because that's the gravity of being human. You don't want to look stupid. And even though you're playing in a comedy, the gravity is to justify what your character is doing. And so on the nights in which they weren't getting laughs, they were doing something different. And that was the key to discovering what became the hidden tools of comedy, that it wasn't that it was a bad audience. It was that we were responsible for what the audience was seeing. Something was occurring, some aspect of performance, some approach to the performance was different, in which, they either were trying too hard to be funny, or they mm-hmm. were protecting themselves, or they were anticipating the laugh. They were doing something to undercut the reality of the character struggling in the moment. It's the old story of these two great this acting couple is having tea, and the guy says to the woman, why didn't I get the laugh when I asked for the cup of tea? And she said, because you asked for the laugh and not the cup of tea.
Yeah.
That is wonderful. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Steve. We really appreciate it.
This has been a pleasure for me, even though my internet access has cut off at several times and I was talking into the void all by myself.
Well, that's all right. We've had a wonderful time. Thank you very much for all you do and for your educating all of us and helping create better and more comedies.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Claire.
Yes, you're most welcome, and Steve, I got to tell you, you are truly brilliant, and I have enjoyed everything you've shared, even in your absence.
well, as many people say, my absence is much desired.
Okay.
All right.
Best of luck.
Be well,
thank
and
you.
Keep up
Thanks.
The great work.
Yes,
thank you.
Yes. Thank you very much. Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Now, in its second edition, Carol Dean's popular book, The Art of Film Funding, has 12 new chapters to cover all areas of film financing and how to avoid expensive pitfalls. Learn how to start with an idea and end with a trailer. How to make an ask for money. Create your story structure and your trailer. Legal advice. Fair use. Successful crowdfunding, how to ask for music rights, and what insurance you can't shoot without. Available on Amazon under Carol Dean and at FromTheHeartProductions.com. I want to remind our listeners that David Raiklin is a brilliant and talented award-winning musician who scores films and can compose music for a trio or for a full orchestra. David is a very good friend to the independent filmmaker and comes highly recommended by From the Heart Productions. If you need music to help tell your story, please contact him at davidraiklin.com. That's davidraiklen.com. And Carol and I want to thank you for tuning in to The Art of Film Funding. Please visit our website at fromtheheartproductions.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good luck with your films, everyone.